Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government magazine, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, exploring pressing public management issues facing us today. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. This edition of the Business of Government magazine provides a glimpse into the many challenges, risks, and opportunities facing today's government executives. More importantly, it introduces a select group of government leaders who offer their insights, outline successes, and tell us how they, in their own unique way, are making a difference in an era of fiscal austerity. Today's conditions require government executives to go beyond simply doing more with less, to find smarter ways of doing business, using resources more efficiently, and investing them more wisely. The dramatic nature of this historical moment cannot be overstated. It is fully revealed by the depths of the vicissitudes being faced. How government leaders respond matters, and the conditions require more than just vague changes. It is to be understood that today's actions affect future choices, and lost opportunities result in ubiquitous costs. In the end, it is not necessarily achieving something ideal from the past, but discovering a new path forward in the present. First up, Conversation with Leaders, featuring government executives who are making a difference. They share their in-depth reflections on the work they do and the efforts they lead. I had the pleasure to speak with Gene Dodaro, Comptroller General of the United States and leader of the Government Accountability Office, on the near and long-term challenges affecting the U.S. federal government budget.
For years, GAO has done long-range simulations of the federal government's fiscal path in order to illustrate what the long-term effects may be of policy decisions, but also changes such as demographics and others. And even before this last recession, you know, we warned that the federal government was increasingly coming along an unsustainable fiscal path. Deficits and debt were accumulating over time. Now, the long-term fiscal position of the federal government is really being driven by changing demographics, as I mentioned, the aging of our society and more people going on the Social Security rolls and also the Medicare, Medicaid rolls. So this demographic wave will hit these entitlement programs over the next few years, and rising health care costs. Those are the two primary drivers. Now, the Budget Control Act of 2011 has improved the federal government's situation. It calls for $2.1 trillion of cuts between 2013 and 2021, and this will help improve the situation in the short term. But even with these changes, in the longer term, there's still a serious issue that needs to be dealt with.
Along with supporting Congress and making necessary budget trade-offs, Dodaro outlines other key strategic goals for GAO.
We've set broad goals, and the goals are rooted in some of the constitutional responsibilities of the Congress. For example, we want to provide timely and quality service to the Congress and the federal government to address current and emerging challenges to the well-being and the financial security of the American people. And this includes everything from health care to education to transportation, et cetera, across the full breadth of the federal government's responsibilities to help achieve this broad goal. And also the second goal is to address the challenges to changing security threats and the challenges of global interdependence. And this includes areas in the national defense, homeland security, international affairs, for example. Third broad goal is to help the government transform itself to improve its programs and activities to meet 21st century challenges. Our last and final goal is to improve ourselves on a continuous basis and to make sure that we are an organization that has the capacity to deliver on its mission, but to continuously improve ourselves in doing so.
Gene Dodaro, Comptroller General of the United States, understands that pursuing these very important goals come with a host of challenges.
It's very important for us always to work on the areas of highest priority for the Congress and key national important issues. Second, like a lot of federal agencies right now, there are budgetary challenges that we're all going to be facing across federal government. GAO is no exception to that. And so we're working through those issues very carefully to make sure that we maintain the quality of our work to the Congress, work on items of highest priority, and also to make sure that we're minimizing any adverse effects on the very dedicated and talented GAO workforce. Thirdly, Michael, I'd say a big challenge is succession planning, because we need to have the right skilled workforce and we need to have the right people in the right job. That's about 75% of success, and so I spent a lot of time dealing with that challenge.
The boomer challenge presents many concerns beyond succession planning. The profound demographic and systematic forces at work in the early 21st century have shaken the core belief that the programs administered by the United States Social Security Administration will be there for future generations. It is at this critical juncture in the history of SSA that it seeks to enhance its ability to meet its mission, eliminate claims backlog, reverse negative trends, improve services, and demonstrate the nexus between adequate funding and the ability to deliver real and measurable progress.
When I accepted the job, the biggest obvious challenge was getting ready for the baby boom. As I started, the National Academy of Sciences had just issued a report saying that the agency was woefully unprepared for the baby boom and needed to really improve electronic services in order to manage the workloads and those sorts of things. And then I came in, the agency was rejecting most of that advice, and I read that report and said, no, these people are pretty much right, and it became part of the blueprint for moving us forward. But it turned out that if we hadn't done that when we did it, we would have just been rocked back on our heels by the recession. Dealing with the added workloads of the recession has been hard enough as it is, but if we did not have the electronic services, we would have been moving backwards in terms of most of the metrics for serving the public. And we were able, despite the increase in workloads and the last 2 years' very severe budget cuts, we are still improving in terms of most key service metrics to the public. And the electronic services has really been a pivotal part of that.
Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the United States Social Security Administration, spoke to me about how, despite the increase in workload and 2 years of very severe budget cuts, SSA is still improving how it does business.
The best way to solve any backlog problem is, to the extent that you're making errors, to pick them up quicker and earlier in the process. And we're doing a pretty good job of that. There are other things that you do to improve quality. But the other thing that we've done that I think has fairly dramatically improved the system is that we have two types of fast-track cases. We have the compassionate allowance cases. You know that with medical certainty. And someone that has that confirmed diagnosis should just be given benefits as quickly as possible. So that's what we do. It's sort of a radical concept. And you can do it with an electronic system. Right now, about 1% of our cases and growing more rapidly are compassionate allowances, about 5% are QDD cases. And we think that number, you know, we took an educated guess. It was largely my back of the envelope estimate with our 2008 plan that we could do 6-9% of our cases that way. Looks like we're going to hit the upper end of that range.
Keeping on that line of thought around service enhancement, Michael Astrew explains the potential benefits of health IT, applying it innovatively to enhance services.
So what we were been very excited by health IT from the get-go, and the Recovery Act encouraged us to spend approximately $25 million getting ready for that. So we've done pilots. We work with MedVirginia. We work with a couple other of the smaller entities around the country that are pretty much already there in terms of supplying electronic medical records. And it's worked extremely well from our vantage point in time. The problem for us right now is just very few insurers are there yet. It's coming, but it's painfully slow.
Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the Social Security Administration, on his legacy and the future.
I think that we've done some very important things on my watch. I think the fast tracking of the disability programs I take a lot of pride in. Introducing high quality electronic services I take a lot of pride in. I think moving a long way to change the direction in terms of the physical IT infrastructure to make sure that the checks continue to go out on a regular basis. That's incredibly important. You know, we're only in this world for a fairly brief period of time. And I think, at least for me, I think you want to take satisfaction away that in some way, even in a small way, what you've done has made the world better. And I think it's much easier to feel that way in public service than a lot of other things that you can do with your life.
The United States military must adapt to a world of dynamic threats and hazards. For the U.S. Air Force, this does not mean change for change's sake, but purposeful transformation with strategic intent, always focusing on the first priority, which is duty to the country and mission execution. In a nutshell, it means fly, fight, win. And of course, building the world's foremost air, space, and cyberspace force requires substantial investment, providing the best possible value to the American people. To that end, the U.S. Air Force must balance capabilities between current combat operations and the need to address emerging threats and challenges, with the ultimate aim to be a lean, lethal, and agile force.
The Air Force in today's fight is providing just a range of capabilities to our joint partners. So we've got our mobility force, which picks up people and equipment and moves it from the United States to wherever it needs to go. They do an amazing job. We've got special operations forces that are working with the other special operations forces from the other services over there. And then obviously we've got our space and cyber capabilities, which allow everybody to do what they need to do on the ground. One of the things as we look ahead under this new fiscal environment, we're very much in line with the President and Secretary Panetta's newly released strategy, which says we're going to continue to maintain our capability in counterterrorism, but we're also going to ensure that we can fight in a range of contingencies. So if anyone challenges us around the world, we're ready to respond to that, including in parts of the world where folks would seek to limit our movement. And we think the Air Force is perfectly suited to operate across that whole range of missions, because we've seen that in the counterterrorism field, the rest of our partners can't fight without the enabling capabilities that we bring.
Erin Connaughton, Undersecretary of the Air Force, outlines the key management challenges facing her service.
You know, I think the three big challenges that we've got, we always think about people first. And so part of what we are focused on is how do you move into this new budgetary context that we know is going to require reductions while doing right by our people? Because the people who serve in the United States Air Force, whether they're in uniform or are civilians, are the backbone of everything that we do. The other big challenge I think that we have is maintaining our operational excellence as the budgets come down. So budgets is a recurring theme here, but it's how we maintain all the good stuff that we want to do, even in a time of fiscal restraint. And it has created opportunities for us to go back and look at how we do business and say, is this really the smartest way to do it? Is it the most cost-effective way to do it? And then, you know, probably not to be tongue-in-cheek, but the third biggest challenge I think we face is time. Time on the calendar, time to get into the whole range of issues we might get into. I think that just demonstrates that the scope of the issues in front of us guarantee that you're not going to get bored on any given day at the office.
As Connaughton notes, budget constraints have created opportunities for the Air Force to change the way it does business, be smarter, and more cost-effective.
So at its most basic level, we're trying to drive improvements in our business processes and trying to make sure that things like business systems, the IT that we buy, that we think about how we're going to use that and that we improve our processes along the way. So there's a lot of work at multiple levels of the organization to look at how we do business and to try to improve it. So on the efficiency side of the house, what we did was we looked at each part of our business. So we looked at logistics, we looked at IT, we looked at our management structure, we looked at support contracts, we looked at acquisition systems, just a range of issues, and we tried to look at industry best practices. So probably the best example I can give you there is in terms of what our mobility air forces, so these are the big transport planes or the refueling planes. They tend to be roughly of the size of commercial airlines, and so we spend a lot of time benchmarking ourselves against best practices in the commercial airline industry. And what we found is that if we could fly smarter, so get rid of excess weight, think about power utilization better, think about flying in ways that are more efficient, that they were able to identify about $715 million worth of fuel efficiencies over a five-year period that could be achieved by making best use of what we know about how the commercial airlines fly. Same thing on the IT side in terms of consolidating data centers and a range of other activities that we've seen in our industrial partners. So in addition to sharing best practices within the Department of Defense, we definitely look to partner with folks in industry and to learn where they're ahead of us, to learn from their experiences as we go forward. So the big challenges for us going forward are actually achieving those things. Changes of that magnitude are not without pain.
The United States Coast Guard has ensured the safety, security, and stewardship of the nation's maritime domain for more than 220 years. The demand for the Coast Guard's unique capability has never been greater. Facing new challenges has required the Coast Guard to organize more efficiently and manage operations more effectively.
Well, you know, I think the Coast Guard is rather, it's certainly unique for this country and unique in comparison to most countries as well. One of the things you find in our Constitution, in fact, it's called the Posse Comitatus Rule, we were abhorrent in terms of using military to enforce domestic law. The Coast Guard is unique because we picked up this character in our culture very early. We were created as a law enforcement agency to enforce the laws of the United States on our waters. We've had this culture of being a law enforcement agency, but also in times of war, in times of need, working with the armed forces, actually being one of the armed forces, but being able to take on this dual role. We've got about 42,000 uniformed active duty people right now. We have 8,000 civilians, 8,000 Coast Guard reservists that we can call up in emergencies. And then we have this other unique organization called the Coast Guard Auxiliary, which is a volunteer organization. Our budget, you asked about the budget, roughly a $10 billion budget, a little less than that proposed in the 13 budget, but we're all facing some budget constraints.
Admiral Robert Papp, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, outlines his strategic vision.
We'd been through 10 years of rapid growth since 9/11 and a lot of increasing responsibilities. And in addition to those increasing responsibilities, both my predecessors had embarked upon major structural reorganization within the Coast Guard. Admiral Collins, who was two before me, did sort of a field-level reorganization for all the right reasons, and I agree with what he did. And then Admiral Allen had taken the upper level of the organization and attempted to do some restructuring, which included a need to get an authorization bill from Congress to do some of these changes. And he never got the bill passed during his 4 years as commandant. So when I came in, there were all these activities going on. Neither one of the restructurings had been completed. And it was taking a lot of institutional energy out of us. And I thought having an impact on our operations as well. So I came up with this first principle of steady the service, which really goes back to my roots as a sailor. Whenever you feel like your ship is a little out of kilter, you've got to shift ballast and get your ship steady, because if you want the ship to perform its missions effectively, you've got to have a steady ship. So I just use that as a metaphor for what I wanted to do with the service as a whole. I wasn't going to bring any wholesale changes, any restructuring. What I wanted to do was complete the reorganizations that had already been embarked upon. The second one was honor our profession. We've got a long and distinguished history with this country. I wanted to refocus on professionalism, building up the proficiency of our workforce, perhaps even cutting back a few responsibilities in order to focus on those core competencies and professional efforts and operational arts that have distinguished us over the years that perhaps had deteriorated a little bit. The third is strengthening our partnerships. That was just a recognition of, once again, I said, we can't do 100% of everything that's given to us on any given day. So we rely upon partnerships within our own department. And then finally, the thing that's probably the pet project of mine is respecting our shipmates. Mm-hmm. We're trying to improve housing and other things for our people, and we'll continue on that effort.
Admiral Papp understands there are challenges in realizing his vision.
The top challenge is, how do you continue to provide the services that the American public has come to expect from their Coast Guard and, quite frankly, deserves? They share their treasure, their taxes goes into our budget, and they have rather high expectations. And we like to meet their expectations. But the challenge is, we cannot do 100% of all our missions on any given day. We have finite resources, only so many ships, so many boats, so many aircraft and people. So what I challenge those two area commanders to do is, they have to decide on a daily basis what are the highest priorities. The second thing is, we embarked about 10 years ago on a recapitalization project, trying to replace our aging fleet and our aging aircraft. The last thing, the third priority, is emerging missions, and probably the one that's foremost in my mind right now is our responsibilities in the Arctic. Shell Oil, and I think the permits are going to be approved by the Department of Interior, will start drilling up there this summer in the Chukchi Sea and the Beaufort Sea, and it's going to increase our responsibilities.
As a maritime nation, the U.S. relies on the sea for prosperity, trade, transportation, and security. We are also an Arctic nation, with the Coast Guard leading the way. Here's Admiral Papp.
We've operated in the Arctic before, but it's been primarily icebreakers going up there and doing research. There's been almost an absence of human activity year-round in the Arctic. That's changing now. And any human activity on U.S. waters means there's a Coast Guard equity, whether it's search and rescue, environmental response, law enforcement, could be icebreaking. But we have all those responsibilities, those broad mandates that we carry out on U.S. waters. There's now more U.S. water to go out and serve. We'll send a ship, and we're going to send one of our new national security cutters. It has a command center with worldwide command and control capabilities. We have hangars for two helicopters on the ship and can launch and recover them. And we've got three boats with boat crews that can be launched from the cutter as well.
Letitia Long, director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, closes this edition of our conversation with leaders, outlining how NGA is putting the power of geospatial intelligence into the hands of its users.
So the way NGA developed this vision was actually talking to the workforce. Our analysts were spending an inordinate amount of time looking for our own information. They weren't spending enough time actually analyzing the information. That's why we have analysts. It's to provide that value added. It's to provide that context. So the putting the power of GeoInt in the hands of the user being the NGA analyst, the user being our customer, was to make our information more readily accessible, easy to access, easy to use. So it really means decoupling our data from the applications from the infrastructure. A common infrastructure, a common set of applications, data that is easily serviceable, if you will. So what we've done is we've created an integrated analytic environment that the analysts enter, and they have access to all of the information through a set of applications. Think your smartphone. Think a smart tablet. That's the environment that we're creating for our analysts. And oh, by the way, we're also creating a similar environment for our customers so that they can come in and find information, or if they can't, enter into a chat with one of our analysts to then be able to serve themselves if they can, or if not, have some assistance.
In a sense, NGA is really transforming its service delivery model. Director Tish Long explains.
We are moving from what has been a full service model for really just about everything we do to a three-tiered service delivery model. Self-service, assisted service, and full service. We'll always maintain that full service. But for many of our customers, many of our users, they can reach in, and if it's a standard product, pull it themselves. If it's something where they want to customize it, if the application is there, it's intuitive and easy to use, they can customize it. If it's not and they need our help, we'll be monitoring their movements, we'll be in those chat rooms, and we'll be able to proactively assist them. As part of the self-service, we also want our users to be able to contribute information. So think of that soldier out there on an operation. They pull the latest imagery or the latest map or the latest GeoInt. They have that for their operation, but if they see something as they're moving that's different than what we have in our database holding, they can take a digital picture, upload it. So a three-tiered delivery model, but also very important in there is user as a contributor.
So how is NGA measuring and evaluating its progress in putting the power of GeoInt into the hands of its users? Here's Director Tish Long.
We needed to have metrics so that we could measure and evaluate how we were doing in achieving the vision. And so we set up a very simple framework. And there are four pieces to the framework. The first is content. We wanted to ensure that there was access to 100% of our content. Easy access, transparent access. That's metric number one. Metric number two is to develop an open IT environment. And that's part of the user as contributor. The user needs to be able to enter into that environment, The third metric is customer service. It is all about the user's experience. So this needed to be an environment that was intuitive and easy to use. And what we're using are business analytics to help us understand whether or not we're achieving that. So we're trying to listen to the user as we go through this. So business analytics are key. And then the fourth metric is analysis, that deepening analysis. Are we providing better information, better knowledge for our key customers? Are we anticipating what could happen? Are we anticipating what they might need and what they're going to ask such that they have it before they even ask it or even know they need to ask it? So it's a simple framework, but I think very powerful in measuring how we're doing.
Next up are profiles in leadership when the special edition of the Business of Government magazine returns.